Welcome. This is the third and last segment of our podcast covering a major exhibition at the Houses of Parliament, Voice and Vote, Women's Place in Parliament.
Using immersive spaces and interactive technologies, this exhibition allows visitors to experience the actual sights, sounds, and objects encountered by women who campaigned for the rights we enjoy today. And what was it like for Nancy Astor and other early women MPs? How did they navigate this uniquely male environment?
Let's listen as Melanie Unwin and Mary Takayanagi, the curators of Voice and Vote, describe the spaces known as the Tomb and the Chambers.
And now we'll move on to the Tomb.
So the Tomb, as you can see, all these names, they're all nicknames that were given by the women who used them. And they all rather indicate that Parliament wasn't particularly welcoming, don't they?
Yes.
Ventilator, the cage, and the tomb. Yes. So the Tomb was the nickname given to the First Lady Members' Room. Now, in Parliament at the beginning of the 20th century, and in fact, all the way through to about the 1970s, individual MPs did not have their own offices.
Oh.
Ministers had their own offices, but MPs didn't. And that's because, of course, most of them were men, and in the 19th century was the same. And they didn't need an office because they came, they sat in the chamber, they sat in the smoking room or the restaurant, because Parliament at that stage was very different from politics and Parliament today. It was more like a gentleman's club.
Mm-hmm.
So when women were allowed to stand as MPs, and the first election came along at the end of 1918. The House authorities, the parliamentary authorities, didn't have any idea how many women might arrive, and they needed to put them somewhere. And so they set up a lady members' room, which was a room with a desk and some easy chairs and a coat peg. And, of course, nobody came because Constance Markovitch didn't take her seat. But the next year, Nancy Astor is elected. And
yes.
She was put into this room. And this was her only kind of safe space in this male institution. When she went and sat in the chamber, obviously she was there and she was outnumbered. She was the only woman. So
she
you can imagine
she was the only woman in the entire chamber.
That's right.
And
only
how many people sit in the chamber?
At that time, well over 700.
Oh my gosh.
So, and they weren't nice to her.
No.
You know, in the press, you'll read all sorts of interviews by men saying, oh, we're delighted to have, you know, Nancy Astor for the first woman MP. They weren't nice to her. When she had to sit down, she had to squeeze along those benches to get to her seat. They wouldn't move their legs to make it easy to go through. They were really horrible to her all the time. They did not want her there. So, thank goodness, she was a feisty, strong, well-informed and socially knew these men outside.
Right.
And, of course, American woman.
She was an American. We bring that out in several of our podcasts, and we brought it out in several of our posts. But it is kind of interesting that
she was born
American.
That's right. And I think possibly that was a slight benefit to her because, of course, she wasn't kind of brought up in a British class system. So
yes.
She was just going to get on with it.
Right.
But
she was a famous hostess.
Absolutely.
And moved in the absolute upper echelons of society. It would be difficult to intimidate her, I think.
I think it would. And most of the men she would have known socially, you know, outside Parliament, they were probably extremely nice to her. She was inviting them, you know, to dinners and to
her
home.
Yes.
That's right. So isn't it interesting that, you know, complete change?
Yes.
And of course, when she arrived as an MP, she got letters from all women all around the country, not just her constituents. They very much viewed her as, you know, their MP because she was a woman. So, you know, she had a huge
prospect. They wrote to
prospect.
Her and hoped for her representation regardless
yes.
of
yeah.
whether.
On all sorts of causes. Yeah, so it wasn't just her constituents.
But now tell me about the outfit.
The
clothing.
Very important. So she's a society lady, Nancy Astor. She can clearly afford and indeed has all sorts
beautiful
clothes. But when she came to Parliament, she decided that she needed the equivalent of a business suit. So she had made for her this very nice, not hugely elaborate couture, but a very straightforward dark suit with a skirt and a jacket, a cream blouse and a soft hat. Of course, hats were all the thing then.
Yes,
everybody
had
a hat.
There'd
been a lot of debate about whether women should take their hats off when they became MPs. All sorts of discussion. And when Nancy Astor arrived on her first day in Parliament, all sorts of hat manufacturers and makers had sent hats for her to wear. They all wanted her to wear her hat. But no, she didn't wear any of these enormous hats. She wore a very soft, unstructured little sort of triangular beret on her head.
So she was doing the opposite of making a fashion statement.
She was absolutely, she wanted to be taken seriously and not just have people talking about what she was wearing today. She
did cover her head in a modest way.
But in a modest way and not with a big couture hat with an enormous brim. But she wanted to be taken seriously. She wanted people and the press to report what she was saying and doing, not what she was wearing. And of course, today, women MPs still have that issue.
Yeah.
Is that the press are more likely to say what they were wearing before what they said.
In the States, what you're wearing on the debates and the presidential candidate debates, everybody critiques the clothes of the women, not the men.
Yeah, absolutely. so it's still the same. But isn't it interesting that she spotted that from day one?
She did.
And realised that. And so fortunately she gave, and this, the outfit that we have is the outfit she wore on the first day when she was sworn in.
You
as
have
a
the
Prime
actual
Minister.
Outfit?
We have the actual outfit.
Oh.
Delighted to say the City of Plymouth, their art gallery and museum own this outfit. It was given by the Astors to the city, amongst a number of other gifts, but they gave this, and so we are borrowing it. So it's very rarely displayed in public, and so we're absolutely delighted to have it here in the building where she would have worn it for the
first
time.
This is wonderful. So the tomb is their office.
It is the office.
And they put all the women in one office.
Absolutely. So, of course, Astor's there on her own, but then
people came.
And then, of course, she was a Conservative. The next woman who was elected was a Liberal. Then the Labour women came along. Their party didn't matter. They were women, so they all had to share the same room. And the room got fuller and fuller.
Well, what did they do when they had too many women in there?
Well, when you visit the exhibition, you'll be able to hear Ellen Wilkinson MP talk about late 20s, about how the fact that there wasn't even a seat for enough, all of them, and that something needed to be done. They did get a slightly bigger room a bit later, but it was women, there are first-hand accounts of women sitting on the floor doing their constituency post bag because there just isn't enough room.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So they tried to make them as uncomfortable as possible.
They certainly weren't going out of their way to make them comfortable.
Oh, goodness. So now the next thing on my list for the tomb, is life peerages. Because now we've entered the House of Commons. So, Mary, tell me, what changed in the other house?
Once women were in the House of Commons, in the tomb and in the chamber, attention then switches to the House of Lords, the other half of the British Parliament. And in the 1920s, we see the first test case from a woman who's trying to sit there. And nobody really tried before that to get women into the Lords because it was a hereditary body in those days. So the men that were all there inherited their seat in the House of Lords from their father and their father before them and their father before them. But there was a small group of women who inherited their peerages through various special reasons, and one of them was Viscountess Rhonda. And she was a suffragette and she was a feminist, and she went down on the Lusitania during the First World War when she was on a business trip coming back from America with her father, and was rescued after hours in the freezing water. And she said that after that she felt she could do anything, so she tried to take her father's seat in the Lords after he died.
But now you say it used to be hereditary.
Yes,
it's no longer?
Right. Yes, so that's the change to life peerages. So after Viscountess Rhonda failed to take her seat in the Lords because the Lord Chancellor just wasn't going to allow it, we then sort of have a period in the interwar period in the early 1950s, where people are discussing the need for the House of Lords to reform, not just because of women, but generally, because it's becoming largely moribund. All these hereditary peers, they're just not showing up to do the work. They're not particularly interested in politics, many of them. And there are days where maybe only a handful of Lords show up, and that's just not enough to do the important work of revising legislation, of scrutinising the government, and so on. And so by 1958, they finally get a solution to this, which is life peerages. And this is to allow members of the House of Lords to be appointed for life and not on the hereditary basis. And this means that you suddenly open up membership of the House of Lords to a much wider and more diverse group of people. More people are willing to accept a peerage on this basis. Many people disagree with the hereditary principle, but would be willing to accept one on a life basis. And this means that both women and men can bring expertise from all sorts of areas of life to the House of Lords for the first time. And by 1958, there's really no reason to exclude women, which doesn't stop some residual opposition to the very end, that there are still Lords willing to stand up in the House of Lords in 1958 and say that this is a House of Lords. We do not wish it to become a House of Lords and Ladies. We don't wish to encounter women in the library. We don't wish to sit next to them on the benches here. You know, the horror of horrors. Where will it all end? But by 1958, which is frighteningly recent, really, for that sort of opinion.
Is.
But by 1958, this is the minority opinion. So the Life Peerages Act is passed, and four women are among the first life peers appointed in 1958. 11 men, four women. And so those four women take their seats in October 1958. And so they are the first women to sit on the red benches in the House of Lords.
And that didn't happen until 1958.
Absolutely. And we have to wait until 1963 for full equality, because the Lady Rhonda wouldn't have been able to take her seat as a hereditary unless she was separately made a life peer. She died, sadly, in 1958, so never got the benefit. But in 1963, finally, they passed the Peerage Act, which is passed mainly for other reasons, but it also allows women hereditary peers to sit for the first time. And so in 1963, finally, this small group of maybe a dozen women with the hereditary peerages are finally allowed to sit on the same basis as men. And so we finally reached full parliamentary equality in 1963.
Okay. Amazing. So that covers the office called the Tomb.
Yes.
Where these women had to fight their way into, even after being elected, had to fight their way into using their influence or making their presence felt.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we have one last area to go through, and you've named that the chambers. Plural?
It is actually plural, because we're representing both the Lords and the Commons chamber in this space, but it's only one space. We didn't think we'd do two chambers. We run out of space at that time in Westminster Hall. So it's a space that represents both chambers. So it's going to have a speaker's chair and a woolsack. In the House of Lords, the Lord Speaker sits on a woolsack, and in the House of Commons...
Now, you need to explain to us what a woolsack is.
Okay, a woolsack is a very, very large cushion full of wool.
Okay.
So it is exactly what it says on the box. It's a large, red, soft
pillow.
Yes.
Okay.
But it's hard. So it's like a puff or something, you know.
Okay.
So you sit on it. That's where the Lord Speaker. And of course, it's full of wool, which used to be very important to Britain.
Yes.
That's where our wealth comes from, really.
Yes, yes.
So that's why it's the woolsack, is it's got all that. It's symbolic. So the Lord Speaker sits there in the House of Lords, and in the House of Commons, of course, the Speaker sits on a chair. So we'll have both of those reproductions of those items, where you can sit and have a selfie taken.
Okay.
And we will have benches. And it's in this space that finally we're actually able to play recordings of real women MPs talking about why they're MPs and what they do.
And now
and
you,
why.
You have a history of doing oral recordings. Didn't you do this somewhere else?
I did used to be an oral historian at the British Library. Yes, many years ago. I'm delighted to say that the History of Parliament Trust and the British Library run a series of oral history recordings of former MPs and women they're particularly interested in. And they're providing us recordings from women right through from the 1960s, 70s, right up to date, talking about how they found the House of Commons when they came, what they wanted to change, and what their aspirations are for the future. And so you'll be able to sit on a bench and you'll be able to listen to their voices.
Oh, wow. So someone from the 50s, was this recorded in the 50s?
No. They're current recordings.
So they can say with some perspective.
Absolutely.
When I got there in the 50s,
this is what I faced. Absolutely.
And this is what I was working on.
Yes.
And we can see how far it's come.
Absolutely. And it's been really important to Mari and I that all the way through the exhibition, we use women's first-hand voices. Now, obviously, in the earlier ones, we've had to use diaries, letters, and other writings that they've left. But now in this final space, we can actually have the voices. And we will also have video film of some of the current MPs talking again about what their experience is, why they want to be an MP, why they think it's a particular legislation is particularly important to them.
That's wonderful. So this is participatory, as I understand, this section. There were ways to participate all through when you're looking through the cage. And
So we've done our best to make it as interactive and as engaging as possible throughout. But particularly in the last section in the chamber, because the idea is that by the time you've walked through 200 years of women's history in Parliament, you will be more likely to vote than before you went in. And not just to vote, but to register to vote if you haven't done that, to sign a petition or start a petition, to give evidence to a select committee like Elizabeth Fry did, and generally to, you know, to engage with Parliament. And so the last part of the exhibition, just before you leave, will offer you all these options, and you'll be able to take a coloured peg and put it in a board, and we will get an idea of our exhibition visitors about what they're going to do after they leave. And so the
so
idea
you sort
is,
of can help, yeah. You're asked to be held a little bit accountable here.
Well, yeah, you should think this, we have always believed that people, once people know their history, they're more likely to appreciate their rights today. If you know how recently your rights were won and how far hard fought they were and how people died for you to be able to exercise your vote, and once people understand this and how recent some of these rights are, you're more likely to go out and use them. And we certainly hope that people leaving the exhibition will want to do that.
Okay, we are anxious to see it. Tell me the dates one more time.
27th of June to 6th of October.
Okay. So anybody who's in London in the summer, please come. Check out Vote 100. They have a wonderful website. The parliamentary website is also a treasure trove of information and exciting things to do. But Vote 100 website is something you should check out before you go. And they also have a Facebook page, which you should see. You should join us at British Heritage Travel on Facebook for Wednesday's Women. We profile one of these exceptional women every week, and it's divided between the British women and American women, so that on both sides of the pond at the same time we were all working for the same thing. So I can't thank you enough, ladies. Melanie Unwin, once again, Mary Takayanagi,
thank you
from
Amy,
the Houses of Parliament, the curators of the Vote 100 project. Thank you very much, Amy. Now that we've heard about the Voice and Vote exhibition from its curators, Melanie and Mary, I'm very anxious to go and immerse myself in the spaces they've created. What a wonderful way to learn about and truly understand the impact of women's achievements in government.
Voice and Vote, Women's Place in Parliament is on display from June 27th till October 6, 2018 in historic Westminster Hall. Book your tickets today at parliament.uk. I'm Lee Ritchie for BritishHeritage.com.
And I'm Amy Griggs.
Till next time, thanks for listening.